So I'm Nick Prococo, and this is Christian, and you're at, this is not the droid you're looking for. Okay. Is that better? Okay, so what you see on the screen is the agenda. We're not going to really talk through it because you're going to see it in the next 50 minutes. But basically, this is what we're going to talk through today, and let's just jump into the introduction here. So a little bit about me. Like I said, I'm Nick Prococo. I'm the Senior Vice President and Head of Spider Labs at Trustwave. About 15 years InfoSec experience. I actually built and still lead the Spider Labs team at Trustwave. Some of my interests, targeted malware, attack prevention, mobile devices, and really from a business and social impact analysis standpoint. And this is Christian here.
Hi, everyone. My name is Christian Papathanasiou. I'm a security consultant at Trustwave based out of London. I've got 8 years in InfoSec. My interests are within rootkit, anti-rootkit detection, algorithmic trading, which is more financial related, and web application security.
Okay, so a little bit of background in our introduction here. So basically, I'm sure everybody here knows what Android is, and that's probably why you're here. It's 60,000 or 100,000. I don't know how many phones are being sold or activated on a daily basis. It's a very popular platform. From what we were able to find, it ranks about number 4 in the handset or the mobile device rankings there. So I guess real show of hands. How many people here in the room have Android phones? Wow. Okay, you guys are all fucked. Not really. We're just going to drop you down a few levels and we'll bring you back up. At the end of this, you'll all be hugging each other. So basically, not much research here. We were able to find has been really done in the mobile rootkit area. And so there's some that's been out there. But basically, Android equals Linux equals, almost a 20-year-old operating system. I remember back when I was, in school, freshman in college, installing a very early version of Linux from a big stack of floppy disks, compiling the kernel for about 8 or 12 hours, and then to find out it actually didn't work. But because of that, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, that it's 20 years old. There's a very established body of knowledge around Linux rootkits, and so we were able to find a lot of information that helped us sort of on our journey here. And so what did we do? We created a kernel-level Android rootkit. It's a loadable kernel module, and it basically is activated or triggered by a phone number, so inbound phone call. So a little bit of background, this is a real nice pretty picture here when we pulled this from Google. This is basically the model for the stack that Android runs on. So basically at the bottom, you see the kernel level, Linux kernel. And at the top, you see the applications. And when I look at this, I sort of think of Time Machine. And not the Mac OS, backup utility. I sort of think of the Time Machine, the book, the book or the movie. Basically at the top, you have the Eloy. Right, the Eloys are up there, and the Morlocks are down at the Linux kernel. The Eloys are like Facebook and Twitter, and they're all excited about that, but they don't see anything below the surface, and they don't know what's going on down there. We'll get a little more on that later, but basically this is what this looks like, and we're going to walk through some of these layers with you. So basically the Linux kernel, that's the base level there. It's based on the Linux 2.6 kernel. It is a hardware abstraction layer, so everything above it doesn't have to worry about the hardware, right? Everything's just represented as a file. Makes it very, very nice and very clean for everything that's above it. It offers the same things that every other Linux kernel offers, memory management, process management, security, networking. But then the whole Android platform that we're going to be talking about really sits on top of that kernel. This is where we focused our attention in the research. We didn't really focus at the application layer. We focused at the kernel level.
The libraries are where most of Android's core functionality lies. The main libraries of interest are SQLite, which is the main storage subsystem. So Android uses SQLite databases for storing its messages, its contact database, and anything really that it needs to store is stored in SQLite databases. For browsing, it uses the WebKit library. And crypto is handled by the SSL library. So one thing that is interesting, based on the libraries that are used, is that because it's a SQLite database, you can read. If you have root access on the device, you can actually read the SMS messages by just using the SQLite client. Another idea / hint is that you can intercept browser sessions by hijacking the library. You can also do that through the kernel. And because it's using SSL, the SSL library, and that requires it to be seeded with a prime random number generator, you can seed that with static low numbers, and that would mean that your cryptos basically can be cracked easily. So Android's runtime environment is the Dalvik VM. What is Dalvik? Well, it's a virtual machine on Android devices. It runs applications which are converted in DEX format. The DEX format is specifically designed for low memory, low processor speed devices, just like your phone. We didn't spend much time here. The application layer is where your user applications lie, like your Facebook app, your Twitter app, your browser. They usually either come with a phone or they are installed with your market app downloaded from the internet. We didn't spend much time here either. So all your higher layer applications, they ultimately interface with the Linux kernel, which acts like a hardware abstraction layer between the hardware and your user lens applications. Therefore, by hijacking the Linux kernel, you in effect hijack the higher layer applications.
And then basically this is where we sort of start to explore the concept of sort of abstracting the rest of the functionality of that phone from the end user. So basically, if you're abstracting everything below the application layer from the end user, that's a usability advantage, right? So your grandma that's using a phone isn't seeing council messages and things popping up on their screen and all sorts of crazy stuff going on. All they know is that they can make a phone call, they can send a text message, they can read their email, and they don't have to worry about anything else below. And that's great. I mean, that's great for a consumer device. But then complete user abstraction in that form is basically somewhat a security disadvantage, right? If someone's on your phone, and we're gonna show what that looks like, but if someone's on your phone doing things at the kernel level, you have no idea. I mean, you really don't know. I mean, I have a phone here, and someone could be on it right now, and I wouldn't know by looking at the screen or using my apps. So that's a security disadvantage. And then even if an attacker's sloppy, they get on a phone and they are causing problems, it causes it to slow down, and now you have to reboot it. The end user's not going to think, well, maybe a hacker's on my phone. They're basically going to think that the phone is crappy. I need to just reboot it. So basically, they'll just call it a bug, or they'll just reboot their phone, and they'll be done with it. So what are some of the motivations behind this? So, people are asking, why did you guys look into this? Why did you guys, write the rootkit? And basically, this was just sort of a discussion that Christian and I had at Black Hat Europe, talking about sort of the implications of someone, of rootkits being on mobile phones. I mean, mobile phones are everywhere, right? So these, 485 million devices on 3G networks. So that basically means that there are that many devices that almost have an always-on connection, right? So my phone's sitting on my table. It's connected to the internet. It's on the 3G network. I go and I drive across town while I'm in the car. It's on there as well. So it's always on, which is very similar to what we saw in the late 90s when people started getting always-on connections in their home. And some research that we looked into showing that by 2010, there will be 10 billion devices on high-speed, always-active online connections. So, that's an incredible growth. It's much faster than you even saw when the PC revolution or the internet revolution took place. I mean, some people have two and three mobile devices that are on 3G networks. And then the other piece there is that 60% of us, maybe even higher, probably much higher percentage of the people in this room, carry those devices with them at all times. So if you think about, you have your home computer, right? You don't carry, well, you may have a laptop, but if you had a home PC and it's plugged into your home network, you're not carting that thing around with you wherever you go. There's people who probably take their phones to the bathroom with them. You probably don't take your PC to the bathroom with you. So basically, for high-profile and business people, even government officials, they probably have that phone with them nearly 100% of the time. I know myself personally; I don't think I've had a smartphone leave a 2-foot perimeter from me, or maybe a little bit further, in probably the last 5 years. So think of the implications of someone gaining access to that phone and doing things like turning on a camera or listening to a conversation or or doing things, other things like that. So, and then the other piece there, the power nature of the smartphone, right? You know, the phone that you have in your pocket today is probably much more powerful than a PC from 8 years ago, or at least the average PC. And so the location aware piece is there as well. You know, you can go wherever you want, and there's GPS on there, and someone could possibly track you. So there are other little motivations here is that users access highly sensitive information from their smartphones. I mean, how many people here have done a single sort of financial transaction from their phone? That may be checking their balance on their bank account or doing something from their smartphone. We got a handful of people here. And then users typically would trust their smartphones before they would trust like another computer, right? I know I would trust my phone before I would trust like a kiosk at a hotel to make a transaction or do something. You don't really ever question your phone's integrity, but in many cases you don't have any ability as an end user. You don't have ability to interrogate the integrity of your phone. I mean, it's sitting on your desk and you walk away and go to the bathroom. You come back, you don't really worry that someone got on your phone while you were gone.
Another motivation for this work is that lots of times for mobile operators to operate within a certain jurisdiction, they must allow governmental entities access to subscriber information. A recent case scenario is in the UAE, where a company called Etisalat pushed a performance update to all their BlackBerry subscribers. This, in essence, was malware which was intentionally installed to allow government officials to monitor BlackBerry users. So BlackBerry users are likely going to be governmental officials or high-ranking executives or business execs. So that was the purpose. So that motivation, instead of an attacker installing it, we're looking also at a governmental entity or a communications service provider installing the rootkit on the actual phone and providing it to you shipped.
So a bit about what we're not doing here. So what we haven't done is developed a new attack vector to get the rootkit on the phone. So, basically there's a lot of, even people who were at the previous presentation, there were some notes about that as well. We're not showing, you're not going to be weaponized to be able to attack everybody's phones here at DEF CON after this talk. But what we did do is we developed the rootkit that's the end result, right? So if you have an exploit that you use our rootkit and deploy on someone's phone, it'll be highly effective. And there's other ways, right? So you have malicious apps that could be deployed that would be able to contain that rootkit on it. And so basically, we chose Android not because we don't like Android. Christian has an Android phone. I'm an iPhone user, but there's no bone to pick with Android at all. We chose it for our research basically because it runs Linux, and everyone has access to the source code, and that really aided us in our research and being able to develop this.
So let's get on to how we built our actual rootkit. What our rootkit is a Linux kernel module, and what a LKM is a software that allows the kernel to be extended dynamically. So usually, if you wanted conventionally to extend your kernel's functionality, what you would usually have to do is write the code, recompile your whole kernel, and reboot your machine into that kernel to have it run. LKMs allow you to flash kind of your kernel dynamically and get that functionality installed immediately. So as it's running in the kernel, it obviously has the same capabilities as code in the kernel. LKMs, in our case, we're hijacking system calls used for file process and network operations. And these system calls are listed in what is called as a system call table. So imagine that's a big array with a whole bunch of system calls which are indexed by a system call number. So how does a kernel rootkit differ from a conventional rootkit? Well, early in the late 1990s or early 2000, there was a couple of rootkits out there, one of which was something called TorrentKit. Which replace system binaries like ls, ps, and netstat. The main difficulty in that was that it was easily detected by doing MD5 timestamp hashes on the actual binaries against known good media. So that would detect that your binaries were tampered with, and that would be a telltale sign that something was wrong. So a kernel rootkit doesn't replace your system binaries. So if you do your MD5 hash against all your system binaries, they all appear the same. What it does is subvert the kernel. Therefore, it's more difficult to detect it. So how do we redirect system calls? We redirect system calls by creating a hook. And what that, in essence, is when the system calls a specific system call, we intercept that and call our own code and then redirect it back. So by doing that, we place ourselves kind of like a man-in-the-middle attack for the system call. Within that man-in-the-middle, within that middle, is our code, our exploit code, which performs the functions we want it to do. So by hijacking the kernel, we are not only subvert the layers above the kernel, but we also subvert the end user himself. While developing this rootkit, there were a few hurdles to overcome. It wasn't as straightforward as it would have been on a usual commodity PC, Linux PC. One of the hurdles, which exists also on commodity PCs, is to retrieve the system call address. Another hurdle was how do we compile the actual module against the source code for the device. And another hurdle which we had to overcome was to enable system call debugging, which would allow us to determine higher layer phone functions, which we would then be able to tap into and hijack and perform actions that we want to perform. So in kernels greater than 2.5, there's a certain memory address called the system call table structure, which is no longer exported. They did that for security reasons primarily, as in kernels 2.4 and below, this was exported by the kernel, and it allowed lots of rootkits to use this functionality to get the address of the syscall table and then hijack the system calls. Recently, around 2006, if I'm not mistaken, there was a FRAC article by a guy called SD and another guy called Sevic, I believe, and that was called obtaining syscall addresses without he basically used devkmem to obtain the syscall table address using certain heuristics. Because all Android devices ship with the same hardware, firmware, and kernel, this is not really necessary in our case. So unless a user has actually flashed their device or rooted their device, which most users haven't, you can simply obtain the syscall table address from the system.map file of the compiled kernel. This also means that you can obtain lots and lots of targets for different devices, and you can create an installation script which, depending on the uname of the actual device, it loads the specific syscall table address for that specific device. We obtained target addresses for the HTC Legend, for the HTC Desire, and for the actual emulator itself. Another hurdle we had to overcome was to load our kernel module within the actual running kernel. It was quite weird because the HTC Legend, they provided the kernel source code for the Legend. And you would expect that if you compile a kernel module against it, it would actually allow you to load it onto the device itself. This wasn't the case because the uname of the actual HTC Legend was extended by saying, instead of 2.6.29, which is the actual default kernel provided by HTC, the uname said it was 2.6.29 9A30 26A7. So when you try to load your kernel, your module into the Legend's kernel, it said the ver magics don't match, and it wouldn't allow you to do that. So we looked into the source code of the actual HTC Legend kernel and modified that, and then recompiled the module against it, and it allowed us to run, to load the module successfully. The file that we modified to load that was a file called utsrelease.h. So at this point, we had successfully loaded our module into the HTC Legends kernel. What we next needed to do was to understand which higher layer phone functions we needed to intercept. Now, all Google Android has hundreds, thousands of APIs. These all, in the end, interface with a set of 255 to 300 system calls. So the main ones which we targeted were the syswrite, sysread, and sysopen, and sysclose system calls. And these are the system calls, these are the functions within the kernel which perform all the read, write, open, and close operations. So by determining the arguments that are passed to these system calls, we can find specific events that we want to hijack. So, having created this syscall debugging script, LKM, which is also available on the DEF CON CD, it allowed us to print all these system call and their arguments, and this was all found in dmessage. Dmessage is basically a log file which shows you all the print Ks that we would send into the that were coming from the kernel with the arguments of those system calls. So what we went on to do was we sent SMS messages to the phone, we called it, and we trapped these events. We then determined that certain events, we can hijack them, and proceeded to hijack them to create our rootkit.
So here's the rootkit itself. So this is a tool called MindTrick. It's an Android rootkit, and basically, you know, explain what it does today, and then we're going to demo it for you. So it allows us to send an attacker a reverse shell over 3G or Wi-Fi. And so basically, once the rootkit is loaded on a phone, if the phone number is defined before the global kernel module is compiled, when it receives a phone number or phone call from that specific phone number, it'll then open up a reverse shell to an IP address that's specified in there as well. So it's basically a trigger. You can define multiple phone numbers. You can find multiple places. It's C code, so you could extend this to it however you want. And then basically, once that happens, the attacker has root access on the phone, and it's a 3G connection or a Wi-Fi connection, whatever it may be, across the internet, wherever you're located, and you can do whatever you want on the user's phone. The user may be on the phone talking, and you're on that person's phone. Also, the rootkit is hidden from the kernel itself, and so we included that in the functionality. And so when you load the kernel, when you load the rootkit, and you do lsmod, it doesn't show up. So the source for that is on the DEF CON CD, so that if you're interested, you can play around with it. So now we get to the live demo, and so we pray to the demo gods that this goes well. We are using a lot of wireless technology in here, which is always a sort of a curse at DEF CON. So this is what we're going to do. And so I'll sort of list these, and then we'll go to the demo, and we'll walk you through them. But basically, we're going to show you how we install the rootkit on the phone. Basically, we'll activate the rootkit via phone call, and so we'll show that. And then you'll see reverse shell open up. And then we'll go through, and Christian will basically show you some exploration there in finding where the SMS messages are, viewing the person's contacts, and then basically looking up the GPS coordinates as well on the phone. And then we'll attempt to make a phantom phone call, but unfortunately, when we were in the speaker ready room, we realized that if he calls my phone, and he types those commands in on the screen, you're going to see my phone number on the screen. And so I'm not sure I really want that. So we may disconnect the screen and run that for you so you can actually see the rootkit calling my phone and making a phantom phone call. Let's jump out.
Yep. So we are connected to the phone right now using what is called the Android debug bridge. And what that is just an interface which allows you to upload files, download files, and get a shell on the actual phone. This is just to allow us to install the rootkit. This isn't an attack vector. This is default functionality provided by Android.
So here's the rootkit itself. So you see mindtrick.ko and so.
I believe I've already installed the rootkit on the phone.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, I already installed it. So I've already installed the rootkit. Just getting ready for the talk. However, how you would install it is just type install mindtrick.ko, and that would load the rootkit into the actual device. We can see with lsmod that the two modules that are currently loaded are the wireless modules for the actual phone. Nothing there denotes anything related to mindtrick. So now we will disconnect from the phone and set up a Netcat listener.
Okay, so now I'm going to attempt to call his phone. And if it works, you should see a shell.
Fingers crossed.
Did not work. Demo gods hate us.
I'll just reboot it.
Okay, so while we're rebooting the phone, anybody have a good joke? I guess that's what happens when you decide to do a run through it in the speaker's ready room. Was that a yes back there? Oh, that's great. So I guess a little bit more about the setup here. So basically, we have a Wi-Fi access point, and hopefully that's not the reason why that's going on. So basically, the phone is on the 3G network, Christian's phone. It has the loadable kernel module, or when it comes up, it should have it loaded on it. And then, basically, when I place a phone call, it should open up a reverse shell. So let's wait a couple minutes. Good thing we're fine on time, so...
Should I check the Wi-Fi? Can you
ping? Yeah, the Wi-Fi should work.
Can you ping mine?
No, yeah. No. Should we try to ping the phone, right?
Yeah. Bit 7?
Mm-hmm. Your phone is up. Okay, so
let's try again. We're connected again to the phone. We'll insmod the rootkit. LSmod shows it's not there. We'll now try disconnect and try again.
There we go.
There we go. One thing to note is that I have no missed call logs here. I also... the phone didn't ring. The volume is up. So that's a functionality provided as well.
Yeah, so we're now on the phone.
We're now actually connected to the phone. And we'll run through obtaining the SMS database. My girlfriend has sent me a couple of texts, so I'll probably clear that quite quickly. And we'll also get the contact database. We'll also try to get some GPS coordinates. Try and initiate a phantom phone call as well. So, as I mentioned previously, the Android uses SQLite for its storage system. So we will use SQLite to connect to the SQL database, to the SMS database, view those, and then likewise with contacts.
A nice long path for us.
So now it's a non-interactive shell, so you won't see the actual SQLite saying I've connected, but we should be able to see the tables if we do that. So those are the tables. So if we type stackstar from incoming message, you get all the texts. Another thing we'll do right now is get the contacts. So these are all the tables in the contacts database. We'll just select everything from wrong contacts. I don't mind if you see these at 20. So these are all the contact database for all that I have on my phone. So the next thing we'll do is get some GPS coordinates.
And one thing we identified when we were trying to look for the GPS coordinates, and we're going to do more research into here, but basically the device, the GPS device, isn't activated unless, an app that's...
Is actively using GPS.
Using GPS. And so we activated basically Google Maps on the phone here. And so now we'll see if we're able to retrieve the GPS coordinates on the phone.
So these are GPS and MEA cord from the serial device, GPS serial device. You can then translate these into Google Maps and get a pinpoint for the actual device. So the next thing we will do is try and initiate a phantom phone call.
Okay. So we'll see how we...
Shall we disconnect or...
You want to move the screen below? Can you type...
Yeah.
Okay.
You can try and move the screen back.
Yeah. Well, actually, does anybody else want us to call their phone? Any volunteers? We do? Okay. Well, why don't you come up on stage here and we'll... It doesn't have to be an Android phone, no.
No.
Okay. Oh, it's a test phone? Cool. Can we get the number? Okay. You have the ringer turned on? Is the ringer turned on?
I can turn it on.
Yeah, turn it on.
Let me give you the number.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
650. 001, right?
Yeah, 001.
01.
65.
650. 336. 3284. 3284. Okay, so one reason somebody would want to do this is, let's say they've made a deal with like a dodgy operator, like sex phone operator or something like that, and they want to get some commission. They would initiate some phantom call like this and let it on for as long as it takes. Hopefully this will work. It takes a while.
Let us know if your phone rings. It's ringing. Yeah, it should be a London phone number. 44 area code.
Yeah,
44.
Should be a London phone number.
Great, so that worked.
Great.
Yeah, so we can go back to the presentation.
Oh,
this is email.
Zima.
Thanks, sir. There we go. Okay. So we were able to show you. Just full screen here. Yeah, so basically we showed you all these things here. The shutting on the phone isn't very exciting. We just do shutdown in the phone.
Just like reboot.
Or reboot, and the phone reboots. But basically, you know, and these are just the functionality that is available, you know, through command line, you know. This could be extended for with automated features. This is a very, very basic rootkit that basically allows you to have that root shell capability. And then it's up to you to type those other commands in, like searching the databases and pulling down the GPS coordinates. So current prevention. So what's the current prevention look like? And this is really, you know, really the main motivation. One of the main motivations we spoke about is just sort of raise awareness here. So we tested both Lookout Mobile Security and Norton smartphone security on this phone with the loadable kernel module or the rootkit loaded, and neither detected it. So that's pretty big awareness there. So there's not a lot of technology out there or solutions out there for end users or for any of us to go and basically prevent or protect ourselves from these types of attacks. So really, so what can be done? What can manufacturers do?
So manufacturers could ensure that all device drivers, LKMs, must be signed by, let's say, HTC, not self-signed by the developers themselves, before they are actually loaded into a kernel. Perhaps not allow you to root your device. That would also help, but personally I wouldn't like that because I like having that functionality. But centrally signing would be the ideal way to go to prevent things like this.
So some of the conclusions. So, through our little journey here that we embarked a couple of months ago, we found that it is definitely possible to write a rootkit for the Android platform. Of course, we didn't include any other functionality. We didn't really go much deeper, but it easily can be done. So I'm sure there's people in this room that will take the source code off of the CD and play around with it and see what else they can do. But then, very little attention has been played, to smartphone security up until this point. There's been great talks the last few days, and even at Black Hat around this topic. And I think the industry is going to really, really start moving in that direction. But basically, it's really because all of us are using our phones nowadays, and even the next 5 years, it's going to really expand to the point where we rely on those devices more than we're going to rely on our PCs or our laptops. So in the next 10 years, we're going to see an explosive growth in mobile devices. And just with how with the internet boom, when you started seeing explosive growth in home computers and other things going on that are connected to the internet, you saw sort of right on path, you started seeing explosive growth in malware and viruses and other things. So there's no reason why we're not going to see the same thing happen for mobile devices. So the big bottom line question is, will we be prepared for that?
And that concludes our talk. Thank you very much for your time.